This is the Bible Show. Welcome, folks, to another episode of the Bible Show. My name is Sam Kasten Smith, and I will be your host today. Joining me is Will Bushman.
What's up, Sam?
And we are continuing in our series on the miracles of Jesus, and today we get to one that is pretty bizarre.
It is.
It is. It's one of the ones where people look at it, you go through the commentaries, and they kind of all shrug, right?
Yeah, you get the end of a really long commentary, and they say, we're not sure about anything we just said, and you're like, just lead with that.
Right.
Help me out, guys. I just wasted some time doing this.
It would have been good to, like, right up front, so you would have known this isn't worth my time. So it's coming from the chapter in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 17, and it is the miracle where Jesus is going to have Peter pulling a coin out of a fish's mouth. And when we began this series on miracles, we said certain things about miracles, right?
Yeah.
So one of them was the miracles show a restoration of the created order. Like, he's making all things right. He's restoring the way the natural order was supposed to be. We talked about a number of other things, but one of the main things is Jesus never does a miracle for selfish reasons.
Yeah.
So he never, like, abuses it and, you know, oh, I don't want to wash my car be clean. Like, you know, he doesn't do something that's ridiculous just to get out of having to work for it. But when you get to this miracle,
it's the closest one where you could be worried about that.
So when the first time I ever did a series on miracles, that was my operating premise. Like, okay, I want to show that every one of the miracles of Jesus points to the gospel. None of them are self-serving. I got to this one and I was like, what in the world do you do with this?
Yeah.
And when you read the commentaries, by the way, they point that out. Like, this, it seems like there has to be something more because this does feel self-serving. And what we want to talk about today is there is actually a lot more.
Yeah.
Behind this miracle that makes this miracle, I think, really beautiful. Hopefully, by the time we get done with this episode, you agree with us and agree that there's more to this. But the context behind this miracle is also instructive. So if you're looking at what is going on in Matthew chapter 17, you have Jesus who's taken his inner circle, Peter, James, and John, up to the Mount of Transfiguration, right? He has just talked with them about how he has to suffer. He's told them, you're going to have to carry your crosses. They're really confused by that. And so he goes and he shows them his glory, and they're amazed at getting a glimpse of his glory.
Yeah.
And then he's like, don't tell anyone about this until after the resurrection. I'm going to have to die. I'm going to be raised from the dead. Then you can tell people about this. And when you study that passage, the whole point of that is he wants them to understand that suffering comes before glory.
Mm-hmm.
If everybody could just have their glory now, that's how we roll, right?
That's how we want it. Yeah.
Easy way out. But the way that God has engineered the whole world and all of human experience, and you could apply this to just about anything and it works, is you either get your glory up front, which means the suffering comes later, or you take the suffering up front with the promise of glory later. So think about how that works with anything. With your health, if you take the glory now, what does that mean you're doing?
You're just treating your body like a circus.
Yeah. I'm eating what I want. I'm doing whatever I want. I'm not exercising. I'm not doing the things that stink, you know, that I don't like to do. Exercising and walking and eating the right things and healthy and vegetables and everything else. So it's like, okay, you can take your suffering now and have a body that lasts and functions the way that it should. You'll have glory later. Or you have your glory now, and you're going to suffer with a body that's breaking down and is unhealthy later. I mean, being a student, you study now, not fun, right? That's kind of suffering in some sense. So that you have glory later. It opens more doors for you. Or you do whatever you want right now, and you go out and you party, and you don't do your homework, and you don't study for tests, and guess what happens later?
Suffering.
Yeah, suffering. All of the opportunities that would have been opened up to you are suddenly close. And so this dynamic of suffering and glory, you find not only all throughout the scriptures where the Bible comes to you and says, hey, you love sacrificially, good things will come out of that. You deny yourself now, you'll have a blessed life. You give up this life on this earth and surrender it to Jesus and follow his design, there's everlasting glory for you in store. And so the God who designed this world and, you know, has that woven all throughout just about everything we do, that's also a message for us for eternity.
Yeah.
Like, you take your suffering now, and then you'll have glory later. And so right before this, you have Jesus who's got three different stories going on. But, and one, the end of the one where he's talking to his disciples who are confused about why they can't cast out demons, you know, he says, by faith, you can do amazing things. So he hits hard on faith, and he says, because of your little faith, you can't cast out demons. For truly I say to you, if you have faith like a grain of mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you. So faith can move mountains, the biggest obstacles, death itself. Then right after that, it says, as they were gathering in Galilee, Jesus said to them, the Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men. This is about a month before the Passover. And they will kill him, and he will be raised on the third day. And they were greatly distressed. So the context that we're jumping into this story is Jesus is talking to them about the importance of faith and how you have to have faith, and faith can move a mountain. And then the other part of this is I'm about to have to go to a cross, but I'm going to be raised on the third day. He's hitting them with the promise that I am going to be raised from the dead so that your faith can move a mountain, right? So then we jump into today's passage with that as the context. In verse 24, it says, when they came to Capernaum, we've been there, it's kind of cool. Like, there, you can see the ruins of the ancient synagogue we talked about before in last episode. But you see the city, you see the ruins, you see all the houses, like the foundations.
Spot on the sea.
It's incredibly beautiful. So like, you can go down to the shoreline and stand in like the rocks on the shoreline, and you're looking out and you're like, it's crazy that Peter fished here. Mm-hmm. You know, Jesus was here. Like,
this is where their boats landed. There's not like, it's not like a huge, like, part of the sea. It's like, no, yeah, like, this is pretty much it.
Yeah, I mean, at the shoreline for this entire town, maybe 200 yards?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not big. Mm-hmm. And so you're right there, and it's like, okay, we're where they were, which is kind of a cool thing. And so they're at Capernaum, and the collectors of the 2 drachma tax went up to Peter. Okay, so stop for a moment. Explain. What is the 2 drachma tax? The 2 drachma tax actually started way back in the days of Moses. So if you jump to Exodus chapter 30, Moses is receiving the law of God on the mountain. God is coming and saying, hey, I want you to build a tabernacle, and I'm going to dwell in the tabernacle. This is going to be where the priests burn incense. It's going to be where the priests offer sacrifices. This is going to be the hub of where all of the worship of God takes place, all of the priests. This is headquarters of God, Inc., right? And so Moses is told, I want you, every time there's a census taken among the people, I want you to impose this 2 drachma tax on all of the residents so that the worship of God can be maintained. The temple can be maintained. Back then it would have been the tabernacle, all of the stuff. We can, you know, take care of priests that are taking care of it, all that kind of stuff. And so this isn't a Roman tax. This is a temple tax. And so what they did back then, and there was a huge debate over it, because when you read Exodus 30, it says when there's a census. Well, they took that to be like, okay, we're just going to collect this every year, whether there's a census or not. So this is an annual tax according to the religious leaders. But some people are like, wait a minute, it says only when there's a census. So I should only have to pay this once a lifetime, usually. And so there's huge debate over who pays this, whether or not you pay it. The priests were exempt. A lot of people claim that the rabbis should also be exempt because they're doing the work of God. And so there's all this controversy over when you pay this tax, because it's not clear who should pay this tax. And now they come up to Peter and they say, hey, does your teacher not pay the tax? Is he one of the people that claims some kind of an exemption
like
that I shouldn't have to do this? Well, I'm a rabbi, you know? And so this is where it's coming from. And Peter says, well, yes, he does. He does pay the tax. Now, why would another reason why this would have been interesting is when you take a census, everybody goes to their home to be counted.
Yeah, like the birth of Jesus.
Correct. Why would this have been an interesting thing? When a census comes, you go to your home to be counted. Jesus has no
home. Oh, yeah.
Right? So it's like, how does he get counted? Does he have to, when he's an adult, a 30-year-old man, does he still go back to Bethlehem, to the home of his aunts? Like, he doesn't have a home. So he, you know, it says the birds have nests and the foxes have their holes in the ground, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. He's literally homeless. He's you know, like Elon Musk doesn't have a home. He's the wealthiest man in the world, but he just stays with other people. Like, that's Jesus's thing. He's staying with other people. Like, he does not have a home of his own, which also adds to the question here. Like, is he counted? Does he pay this thing? And so, but Peter says, yes, he does. He pays the tax. And, you know, he might have been like, just go away. I don't want to be in trouble here.
And this whole thing's confusing because they do say, does your teacher not pay the tax? And Peter just says, yes.
Like he's answering a negative.
Does he not pay? Or what are you expecting? You're like, I'm confused about what we're doing here. We get, obviously things happen. But at first you're like, are you guys talking to each other correctly? Like, do you guys know what each other's saying?
Oh, that's good stuff. Yeah, so I don't know what question he's answering. There you go.
And these poor guys that are coming to get the tax from Jesus, they had to have heard who Jesus is, and they haven't approached him yet. He's in and out of Capernaum all the time, and now all of a sudden they're like, let's get our hands on these two drachmas finally.
Yeah, so but the beginning of Jesus' ministry, there's still some confusion about, like, we're a month before his death right now. Because that, by the way, when you read it, and this is one of the things we take from church tradition, you could go to Jerusalem to pay the tax, but because a lot of people didn't make the pilgrimage, they sent out all these tax collectors for the temple to say, are you going to pay the tax? Like, or you could pay it there.
And are these guys the tax collectors?
And they did that a month ahead of time.
Are these guys trained? These aren't the trained religious leaders. So the trained religious leaders would like make decisions like, Jesus, you have to pay this tax. Whereas these guys are just going around like kind of hoping if anything goes wrong, don't they have to go back to Jerusalem, get everybody's opinion?
So they would have had, like, the religious leaders are there in the, like, okay, you know, the person who runs the synagogue, the ruler of the synagogue. Like, he would have been able to
authoritatively
impose
say,
consequences or whatever. But it's not like the Roman guards are going, oh, give us your temple tax. Like, this is purely a Jewish thing.
Yeah.
So it says, Peter says yes, and then he comes into the house, and Jesus, which, first part of the miracle here.
Yes.
Jesus spoke to him first. Like, Jesus isn't there when the conversation's going on, and yet he knows exactly the conversation that's
happened. It's so nice to Peter, because Peter's, again, probably like, oh, I have to go talk to Jesus about this. Like, I got to be this guy all the time.
Jesus, it's time to pay the tax.
Yeah, don't want to do this to you, Jesus. We need some coins.
But Jesus is taking this as an opportunity to teach. And it says, when Peter comes into the house, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, what do you think, Simon? Now, Simon is his given name. When Jesus changes his name to Kephas, which is the rock, or in when it becomes Latin, it's Petros, which is where we get Peter. But his given name is Simon, or later he's called Simon Peter. What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth take toll or tax? Do they take it from their sons or from others? What's behind that question? I think government needs to go away from our lives, and I think that's a very biblical position. Governments are corrupt and limited.
They usually do bad things in the Bible.
Beautiful thing. So Jesus is stating this. Like, the first time, you go back to 1 Samuel chapter 8, when all of Israel is like, we want to be like all the rest of the countries. We want a king. What does God do? Through the prophet Samuel.
Like, warns them.
You don't want a king.
Yeah.
Humans with authority will abuse you. They're gonna take everything from you. If you're the enemy, if you're a political adversary, they're going to punish you, they're going to exploit you, and they're going to do so for the advantage of their own families and their own allies. This is natural progression of all of humanity through all time. When it comes to your political rulers, they will disadvantage their adversaries to advantage their friends, right? And so Jesus is stating here a very anti-government sentiment. Thank you very much. God himself, you know, making the case here. Hey, do kings of the earth, which, by the way, you have a heavenly king.
Even earthly kings.
And earthly kings. And he says, do they take their toll or tax from their sons or from others? what's the answer that he expects?
Others.
Of course. You never tax your own son. You give it every advantage to those that are close to you, and you punish others. I mean, we see that in government again and again, where we have corrupt regimes that protect those that are close to them and keep them out of trouble, and engineer entire justice departments to make sure that things are not done, and everyone else is treated to a much different standard. I mean, I'm not mentioning anything specific.
Not our government.
Good grief.
Not the US of A.
Yeah, but like, right, where you have half of the country who feels like justice is weaponized. That's not a good thing. Mm-hmm. And now we're talking about a religious tax, no less. And still you have Jesus saying, do the kings of earth take the toll from their sons or from others? And he knows the answer. Everybody knows the answer. We fear who's in power, because if they're not on our team, we know that they're going to be harder on us. Which is why, by the way, limited government and a constitution that limits powers and everything else is so valuable, and it's so worth protecting. It's super biblical. But Peter knows the answer, and he says, well, from others. And Jesus said to him, then the sons are free. Now that's powerful, right? He knows this. Yeah, you're right. Like a king is always going to tax others, but he would never expect penalty, payment, whatever, from the sons. And so the sons are free. So what he's saying here is, in principle, in front of God, we're clear.
Yeah.
Right? There's nothing expected. If you're a son of God, then there's no payment expected from you. However, so he stops and he says, however, not to give offense to them, because if we tell them we're not paying the tax, here we go. We're going to have a war with them, and it's over a stupid little coin. So as to not offend them or cause some kind of a scandal, he says, I want you to go to the Sea of Galilee, hop, skip, and a jump down the walkway, cast a hook and take the first fish that comes up. And when you open its mouth, you will find a shekel. Take that. Now, a shekel is the equivalent of two drachma taxes. So 4 drachma. He's like, take that and give it to them for me and for yourself. And that's the whole miracle. And by the way, it doesn't say
that
Peter went and did it. But you assume it did, because Jesus said that's what's going to happen. You assume
and that this miracle took place. And now it's chasing after
them. Right.
They're allowed to move on with their lives.
That's right. So what in the world do you do with this miracle? And this is where, when you read the commentaries, they're like, cool miracle.
That's
good.
Not
sure why Jesus did that. But like, when I'm reading this, because I'm you know, a skeptic by nature, like I need, and this is not a good thing. It's not like, God, you do whatever you want because you're God, and I'm not. Like, I always want to know the why question, which makes faith even harder, because it's like, details. Why are you doing this? Why make this decision? Why aren't you bringing a revival? Why aren't you, like, I'm always wanting to know, what are you up to, God? Like, help me understand this, and I'll follow with my whole heart. But when God says, I'm not going to show you why, you just have to follow because I'm God and you're not, that is so hard for me. And I know that he deserves that, because he's God and I'm not, and he's smarter, and I know his ends are going to be better than whatever I had planned. But that's really hard, because I like to know the why questions. And so I'm looking at this and I'm like, I don't like this. I don't like this at all, Jesus. Because this is like, everybody else has to go get a job. Everybody else is out there working. Everybody else has to go catch fish or plant crops or do whatever to pay their tax. And you're like, hey, go cast a line and we'll kind of cut corners so you can get a tax payment and we won't have to go get a job or whatever to pay this. I don't like that.
Yeah.
So what do you do? What do you do with this?
I'm fine with it.
You're fine with him just cutting corners like that?
I don't think he's cutting corners.
But it's like his whole character. Like, he doesn't ever do that. That's part of the unbelievable beauty of Jesus, is that he never takes advantage of his godness.
Yeah.
Like, he comes into this world, and that makes his relatability to us so wonderful, as he doesn't cut corners, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he knows what it's like to be betrayed. He doesn't, like, you know, put magic sprinkle dust and be like, I'm going to take the easy way. Everyone's going to love me. Yeah. He's not always doing things so that he gets out of the hardship. So when you see him do something that's like, everyone else had to go get a job and you didn't relate to them in this case, you always relate to them. Why did you do this? And so that's when I started like looking into this miracle, trying to find the symbolism of what's going on here. And when I find it, like, I really do believe that this is the case. And I don't see this in the commentaries.
Yeah, you spent more time on this than anyone in the world, so.
Because it bothered me.
Yeah, I know.
But now it's one of my very favorite miracles because of what it teaches and what it means for us, right? He looks at Peter and says, the sons are free. So let's back up here, okay? And let's consider what's going on. Where's this temple tax going? What is it used for? Remember?
The temple.
To keep up the temple, right? You got to, things are falling apart. You got to maintain it, make it look nice. You got to pay the salaries. You got to bring in the stuff, new equipment and all the utensils that are used there. Like everything has to be replaced so that the temple stays nice, right?
Yeah.
Now, whenever Jesus is talking about the temple in the Gospels, how does he talk about it?
Destroy this temple in 3 days. I'll rebuild it.
Yeah.
Flipping tables.
It's gross. This was meant to be a house of prayer. Look at it now. It's corrupt. He's telling the disciples, like, you see all these buildings, including that temple that's so glorious, that's so amazing. Like, not one stone's going to be left on top of one another. And then there's this whole transition throughout the entirety of the New Testament that says we're doing away with that temple, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why? What is going to become the temple?
Well, we will after Jesus' sacrifice.
Right? So Jesus, when he says, tear down this temple and I'll rebuild it in 3 days, the Bible says he's talking about his body. So he is the temple of God. He's human flesh, you know, a tent of flesh that's housing the glory of God. He is the greater tabernacle, mm-hmm. the greater temple. And yet when he goes to the cross and he takes your sin and he imputes his righteousness to you, then all of a sudden, you're made clean and you're made to be a worthy vessel whereby the Holy Spirit now comes and dwells in you, which makes you what?
The temple.
The temple. 1 Corinthians 3, 1 Corinthians 6. Do you not know that you're a temple of God? Pentecost, right? And the aftermath of the resurrection and ascension of Christ, the Holy Spirit comes and dwells in the apostles and starts manifesting things in them. And so you have Jesus focusing, laser focused on the construction of temples. And here we have this temple tax, which is precisely for that. It goes to construct, reconstruct, to make new the temple. And who pays for that?
The Jews, the people of God.
The Jews pay for the physical temple.
Oh, yeah.
Who pays to make you a
Jesus.
Temple? Jesus. How much does he pay?
Definitely his life.
His life. He lays it all down. Like, he makes the ultimate payment so that you can become a temple. And the construction of your temple and the upkeep of your temple and the maintenance of your temple and the forgiveness and cleansing and constant forgiveness, like, who pays that? Jesus does. And so the sons are free. You're a son. That means, what do you have to pay?
Nothing.
Nothing. That's a gospel message, right? That's mm-hmm. that's soteriology 101. Like, the only thing that you bring to your salvation is the sin that made it necessary and the faith that triggers the grace of God, right? That's it. And he even gives you the faith that triggers forgiveness and everything else. And so in that sense, what he's saying is, okay, I'm building temples, but the sons don't pay. That's remarkable. So there's two other points of symbolism in this that are pretty cool. He tells Peter, I want you to go down to the Sea of Galilee and I want you to catch a fish. First fish you catch. Now, there's a fish that dwells in the Sea of Galilee. It is the most common fish, and it's called a mango tilapia. I don't know why mango, but if you look it up, go Google it. It's called St. Peter's fish, and it's a tiny little fish. It's a nice fish, but this is almost certainly what Peter catches. And the reason why I say that is this fish does something that's pretty unique and pretty cool.
It's wild.
When the female fish goes up to the shores, like, and it lays eggs all through the rocks, and we've stood on those rocks, right? They lay their eggs all over the rocks, and then the male fish comes and fertilizes them, you know, drops the necessary stuff, like, fertilizes the eggs. But then what the mother does is, you know, the period before these things hatch is like 10 to 12 days. So the mother comes by with her mouth and just goes down to the rocks and is swimming around and sucks up all these newly fertilized eggs and keeps the eggs in her mouth for 10 to 12 days. And there's videos of this, which, you know, you can see on YouTube, where after 10 to 12 days, the mother just starts like belching and looks like puking up. And you just see hundreds of little fish just coming out of her mouth, right? And so think about that. What is that? Here's a mother that is bringing forth many sons and daughters out of the mouth of this fish. Mm-hmm. What's the whole idea of what Jesus is communicating here? Like, the sons are free. So out of this, the mouth of this fish, you see this imagery of sons, children are coming forth out of this fish, right? Now, that's, if you said to a fisherman, go get me a coin out of that fish's mouth, they're immediately going, oh, this is the kind of fish that brings forth children and new life out of the mouth, spits them up, right? Mm-hmm. So you've got that imagery. So not only do you have Jesus saying, okay, this is for the construction of temples, you don't pay, I'm paying for that, right? I'm going to go to the cross. I'm going to make the ultimate payment so that you can become the temple. I'm going to build far greater temples with the payment that I'm putting forward. Then the next picture that you see here is new life coming out of the mouth of a fish.
Yeah.
So you've got temple, crucifixion, resurrection imagery, coupled with new life coming out of the mouth of a fish. And then the last one is, so Jesus throughout his whole ministry will give two ways that he talks about his resurrection. So when the religious leaders are all running around going, we want a sign. And you're like, dude, like, how many signs does this guy
open your eyes,
right? He's done all of these miracles. And they're like, we demand a sign. And Jesus will say things like, tear down this temple, I'll rebuild it in 3 days. But then the other one that he repeats even more is, this wicked and adulterous generation demands a sign. And I'm telling you, I'm going to give it one sign. And he says, the sign of Jonah. For just as Jonah was in the belly of the fish for 3 days and three nights, so too must the Son of Man be in the belly of the earth for 3 days and three nights. And so, like, with the commenting on the resurrection, he talks about temple imagery, check, in this miracle. He's paying for the construction of the temple. And then he talks about Jonah. How does the story of Jonah go? He's thrown into the sea. He's
running from God.
And then what?
It's a sacrifice for the people in the boat.
Yeah. The sea goes calm for them. He is swallowed by a
large fish.
A great sea creature. A large fish. And then what happens to him? He goes, that goes down for 3 days. Jonah's in the belly of the fish, repenting to God. He acknowledges that this is the depths of Sheol out of his own mouth. This is the grave for him. And then on the third day, what happens? This fish comes to shore.
Spits him up.
And he's spit out. And Jesus says, that is the resurrection. And so now I want you to get this. Jesus, and this isn't, like, the imagery's not an accident, because it's such a bizarre thing. You're going to pull a coin out of a fish's mouth, like, what? Like, that's just a bizarre thing.
Just go get it from the rocks. Like, if you just want a coin, put it anywhere.
Why combine all that? So the first one is, this coin is going to be to pay for the temple. I'm paying for you to become a temple. New life coming out of the mouth of the fish. And then the next thing is, you have a fish brought to shore, and it's literally, you know, This is the picture of Jonah. This is another image of the resurrection, where Peter is calling on this fish to regurgitate up a coin.
Yeah.
The same place where all the sons and daughter fish come out of the mouth. And this coin that pays for the new temple comes out. And so you have this merger of three different things in the scripture, all of which are pointing to the fact that you are a son. You don't have to pay. Jesus will pay the entirety of what it takes to make you a cleansed temple. And by the way, just throw in the sign of Jonah into the middle of this miracle.
Cherry on top.
Just for good measure. And what is the whole point of it? You don't have to pay.
Jeez.
Because you're a son. And the sons are free.
And is that why the whole supernatural element of the fish and the coin miraculously appearing had to happen? Because if Jesus just took two coins out of his pocket. Like yeah. you said, they're not working right now. So those were gifts from somebody else. Or if Peter's like, oh, I got this one, Jesus, then what it costed Peter.
Yeah.
It would have costed some follower of Jesus. But Jesus is making very clear, like, hey, this coin's not coming out of anybody's pockets. I'm going to supernaturally supply it.
100%. Okay. This is all on Jesus. It doesn't impact Peter. He's learning here. Like, oh, okay.
Maybe.
And you got to think, right, yeah, with Peter. So, but one of the things that's fascinating, and this gets back to the sovereignty of God, like, you know, you jump into your imagination and you think, okay, how in the world does a fish get a coin in its mouth? Well, maybe at some point, and you're trying to like, does he just create it ex nihilo out of nothing to where like the fish is just swimming around and all of a sudden it's like, oh, I got a coin in my mouth.
All of a sudden there's a hook. He's like, oh.
And a hook. Oh, that looks good. Like he's bringing in sovereignly all these things that have to happen. So like in my mind's eye, I'm thinking of, you know, a guy walking along the shore that all of a sudden flings a shekel into the water. Like, what? Why? What did that? What? Or a fisherman maybe stumbled in a boat and lost a shekel that goes down into the middle of these eggs that some fish then later comes by and has to suck up the eggs. And then Peter's like, oh, I'll throw the hook here. And of all the fish in the entire Sea of Galilee, Jesus, who is sovereign over all of it, is like, that fish, that hook, go. Yeah. You think about the sovereignty that it requires and the fact that this was set in motion from the moment whatever guy lost a shekel in the water at the precise right place for the precise right fish who's going into mating at the precise right time that's laying eggs in the precise right spot that sucks. So the miracle behind this, like it's almost like Peter sees this, and I don't know that he would have gotten all the temple and Jonah imagery, at least not right away. But the sovereignty of it all, like how did he do that? Like that's wild. So I don't have to pay this, and it's a reminder, like this is God. And the one of the great ironies of this is the shekel tax. It's for the temple, and it was different than what the Roman tax would have been. So the Roman tax was, you know, denarius. It, you know, and it had images and inscriptions to Caesar on it. And so the Jews so hated the Romans that they refused for a temple tax anything that had Roman insignia of it or any acknowledgement of Tiberius or anything like that. And so the only coin that was allowed for the temple tax was what's called a Tyrian shekel or a Tyrian coin, and coming from the city of Tyre. And what's fascinating about that is it's not religious. Like on one side of the coin is an image of what they considered to be a god. Ultimately, it traces back to Baal, but they gave it different names. So it's a pagan image on one side of the coin, and on the other side of the coin is an eagle. So pagan, violating the second commandment all over this coin. But it was also of a greater purity of silver. Mm. So a Roman coin, you know, was probably up to 80% silver. Like if you go to coin dealers, they're like, oh, the Tyrian coin, that had to be at least 94% silver. So they were more valuable. And so in a sense, like the whole point of the temple tax and all the stuff that they're doing, like the money changers and everything else, where when you came to the temple, when Jesus knocks over all the tables and everything else and starts breaking out the whips, part of the reason why he's doing that is people would come with money and they would come with denarius or whatever. And the religious leaders would be like, we will not take Roman money. You have to go to the money changers to get your Tyrian shekels before you're allowed to buy here. And then they would put exchange rates that were crazy and really rip everybody off. And Jesus is like, you're making what's supposed to be about God the Father and prayer into a business whereby you're ripping people off that are desperate to grow closer to Jesus. Yeah. How gross. And so even behind all this, behind all the temple tax, like there's business elements of it where there's greed. And, you know, we want the coin with the greater purity of silver and da 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 da. And Jesus is just like, bleh.
Yeah.
You know? And we were talking about this a little bit earlier before recording. Like one of the great dangers in ministry is that you allow the wealthy or the financial aspects of the church ever be governed, like to allow them a seat at the table of governance because of money. If there's a wealthy person who wants this and the right thing to do is this. The job of the church is to say no. Like, I
don't have power here.
Yeah. If you're generous, great. But your opinion holds absolutely no more sway over the church than the widow over here who gave her two mites and owns nothing. You know, money should never sway the body of Christ. And in a sense here, when Jesus is like, go get a shekel out of the fish, it's like he's saying, I'm not playing this. Like, I'm just, you're free, but so that they don't get offended, give them that.
Even just the provision of God that Peter's not, you know, Peter's main focus right now is ministry right now. Mm-hmm. So Jesus is like, okay, let's make this distraction free for you. I'm going to supernaturally provide this coin so we can remain on mission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing how many times he uses the Sea of Galilee as an instructive tool. You know, like when Peter catches the great fish, yeah, after fishing forever and ever and ever and not catching a single thing, and when he's first called into ministry and he says, you know, take out, go dump your nets one more time, and then there's this huge fish. Like, what made Peter realize that he was God was that, hold on a minute, I've been out here all night, drop these nets time and time and time and time and time and time again, and there's no fish, like not one. And then you command it, and all of a sudden, all of the fish in the Sea of Galilee know to jump in this net all of a sudden, and they do so at your will, and I pull it up, and that's when Peter's like, depart from me, Lord, for I'm a sinful man. He knows who this guy is. And in some sense, in this case, right after Jesus is saying, I got to go to Jerusalem, I'm going to be arrested, I'm going to be harassed, I'm going to be beaten, I'm going to be murdered, I'm going to be crucified. By the religious leaders, by the way, the same ones that are demanding this temple tax, I'm going to be raised from the dead. The temple is going to be rebuilt. Jonah is going to be spit out of the whale again, you know, in the resurrection metaphor. And then he jumps right into this miracle. And the great thing is, and so all this miracle set all the curiosities and ins and outs of this miracle aside, what's the meaning? Jesus loves you so much that he leaves nothing for you to pay.
Yeah.
The sons and the daughters are free.
Yes.
You will not be forced to pay, which sets him aside as a king of a heavenly realm, of an everlasting citizenship, of an eternal kingdom where justice and everything else cannot be shaken. Peace will never be taken away from you. It is yours, and it's yours forever. You'll never be made to pay. And by contrast over here, and this is a religious bunch of people, right?
Yeah. Still got to pay.
The kings of this earth, even the religious leaders of this earth, they'll make you pay.
Yes.
They want something from you. Yeah. You've got to do something to get their love. And if you're on the wrong side of them, there's going to be pain for you.
Yes.
So where do you put your hope? Where do you put your hope, Peter? Which king are you chasing after? Which kingdom are you putting all of your eggs in their basket, right? Like, I am the king that does not make my sons and daughters pay. I will pay it all. Those kings will go after their adversaries and make them pay. I'm the kind of king, I pay for my adversaries too, to make them sons and daughters. This whole miracle is just incredibly beautiful.
And just so gracious, like, to use what Peter would know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Peter knows fishing. He knows the Sea of Galilee. Peter didn't understand right before when he's like, hey, the Son of Man has to die. Greatly terrified.
Huh.
And then she's like, okay, I see you. So let me do a little object lesson here using what you know. Something that you can understand. Something that you can comprehend. And just so gracious. And is this the only hook fishing we had got in the Bible?
Yeah.
The only time I've ever heard of hooks.
Yeah.
Huh.
So a lot of, like, some of the commentaries that had stuff to say, would they did mention that this would have been humiliating for Peter.
Huh.
Like, serious professional fishermen that break out the nets and everything else looked at hook fishing like, those people.
Well, yeah, because
they don't know what they're doing.
It's useless because, like, you don't want one fish if you're a professional fisherman.
Correct.
Like, you're looking for more is more. More is mm-hmm. better. So, and also the specificity of his sovereignty to be like, no, I don't need you to catch 10 and we'll find one. It's like, no, just stick that empty hook in there.
Yeah, that's right. And so You have Jesus who presents this message. You jump to Matthew 18 right after this. What are they arguing about?
Who's going to be the greatest?
Right? Like,
I love them.
Hey, when we go into your kingdom, like, who's going to be the best one? And it's like, good grief. Like, so clearly, even after he's like, I got it all. You know, the sons are free. The daughters are free. I got it all. I pay it all. The next thing they're like, okay, yeah, but who's the greatest?
Yeah. Tell us, Jesus.
Yeah. How do we earn it still? And that's just the human condition. And Jesus still doesn't smack them upside the head and say, I'm done with you. He says, you know, unless you become like little children, which means what? Entirely dependent, totally naive.
And you're just jazzed at the table. Yeah. Remember the first time you get to leave the kids' table for like
that's true.
Family holidays? You're like, I don't care what seat I get. I just want to sit there and not with these four-year-olds.
Yeah, that's true. And so what he's saying is, You have to be like children. You just know that your parents are going to feed you. They're going to love you. You're never going to be, you know, a four-year-old doesn't have to worry that if they don't do their homework, they're getting evicted, you know. It's going to be okay. Your parents got this. They're going to take care of you. And this is right after, hey, the sons are free.
Yes.
Stop.
Yeah.
Stop trying to earn it. You're going to become a far greater temple, and I will pay it all. Amen.
Amen.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of The Bible Show. We appreciate you if you would like and subscribe to the show. Also, if you're not aware, we have another show called Under the Hood. So you can check that out on YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok. Under the Hood FL is the title. Check it out. We've got a lot of good episodes there. And we just want to thank you for being part of our crew. It's a lot of fun to produce these. And so we wish you a great week. God bless. Thanks for listening to The Bible Show. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to like and subscribe and leave a kind review to help us in the world of tech algorithms. Also, feel free to share with a friend. We'll see you next week with another episode of The Bible Show.